the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Well, good evening. My name's Joe, and to those of you who I don't know, and I'm a member here at Belmont. I have been for about 5 years, and it was great walking in tonight, wasn't it? I felt like I was walking a bit into an awards ceremony or something, and I think Off the Wall are going to have a really great time later. I'm looking forward to the mocktails. And yeah, guys, those of you who are going away at the back and over here and down here, we'll really miss you, and we'll definitely be praying for you and for those things that you said. And for those of you that are still going to be here, we're really glad that we're keeping you. So 1 Timothy chapter 6 is what we're looking at, and if you've been here for the last few weeks, you'll know that we've been working our way through a series called Flashpoints, where we've looked at different points in the New Testament and how that how those kind of things could cause anger or certain other things between Christians, how they could divide Christians. The reason that we're looking at that is because we don't want the same things to happen to us. We're really lucky at the moment. We are united as a church. We enjoy unity together and working together. But we don't want that to change. We want to be aware of these things, and we want to see what Paul and some of the other New Testament writers had to say about them and how that can affect us today. And we're looking at 1 Timothy 6 this evening, which Emma read really well earlier. Just to give you a bit of background to that, to 1 Timothy 6. So Jesus has died. We're in the New Testament. Jesus came to earth, lived his life, then died on the cross and rose again. And then he appeared to his disciples and sent them out to go and tell people that good news. His disciples went out and told people the good news. And then Jesus appeared to one person in particular called Saul and said, "Saul, you're going to change your name to Paul. And Paul, you're going to go and preach the gospel to people who haven't heard it before." That was amazing, because Saul had been persecuting Christians. He wanted to wipe them off the face of the earth. He was not a nice guy. But he changed his life around after meeting Jesus. So he went from persecuting Jesus and persecuting Christians to following Jesus and wanting to tell other people about him. One of the places that Paul went to was to Ephesus, which is in Turkey today. And he went there and met some believers there and started to establish the church in Ephesus. They had some problems from the start. Ephesus was quite a wealthy city, so you can see the Colosseum as it is today, a really rich trading city. Businesses were flourishing. It was a big city, one of the biggest cities in the Roman Empire, and the church had some problems from the start. The main reason for those problems was that Ephesus was home to the Temple of Artemis, who was a Greek goddess, or the Roman goddess Diana. Lots of people made pilgrimages to Ephesus to kind of worship Artemis, the Greek goddess. And also local businesses made lots of money out of this. They made lots of shrines of Artemis, they made statues, and they made lots of money. So you can imagine, when Paul went to Ephesus and the church began and people turned away from this and started following Jesus, people lost money, and generally when people lose money, they aren't happy. So people started riots. The church faced lots of persecution right from the start. But the church continued to grow, and eventually Paul stayed there a while, but then Paul left Ephesus. And when he left, he said a really emotional goodbye to the leaders of the church in Ephesus. They'd been really close. They'd got on really well. It says in the Bible, when he left, they wept together, they prayed together. But Paul warned them. You can read about this if you want to in Acts 19 and Acts 20. Paul warned them. He said, "People are going to come in like wolves and cause you problems. And also, people are going to rise up from within your own church and start to lead people astray from Jesus." So Paul prophesied that when he left, and that prophecy came true. People rose up from within the church itself in Ephesus. And that's what we read about earlier. Those false teachers rose up from within the church and began leading people astray from the true gospel and from Jesus himself. And so Paul sent his friend Timothy. Timothy and Paul had a kind of father-son relationship. They got on really well. They were friends too. And Paul sent his friend Timothy back to Ephesus to try and sort out some of those problems. And then that's why we come to 1 Timothy. Paul wrote this letter to Timothy to encourage him whilst he was there in Ephesus, to help him in battling against and kind of condemning what those false teachers were teaching. So that's where we are, and that's where we come to 1 Timothy chapter 6, near the end of the letter. And I'm really excited tonight, as we look through that, at three different things. I'm really excited how God's going to speak to us, because he says that his word is powerful, and that he speaks to us through it. And I'm really praying, and have been praying, that he challenges us tonight, because it's really relevant for us today. Not just for churches who have false teachers leading people astray, but some of the things Paul gets into, like Nathan said earlier, putting anything, specifically your own reputation and money, ahead of Jesus can have disastrous consequences. And Paul talks about those things in this passage and what some of the answers are. We're going to look at three different things, the same structure that John's been using in some of the rest of the series. We're going to look at some of the causes of this flashpoint. What were the causes of the false teachers preaching what they were preaching? Some of the risks, what were the results of that? And then some of the answers as well. So first of all, the causes. Who were these false teachers and what were they teaching? First of all, what were they teaching? Well, I don't really know exactly. And most commentators don't really know exactly. And in fact, the false teachers themselves didn't really know exactly what they were teaching. We know it had something to do with something. So 1 Timothy 1, it says, they devoted themselves to myths and endless genealogies. So they cared about where people came from. Some of them said, if your great-great-grandfather wasn't particularly holy, then how can you be holy? 1 Timothy chapter 4, they forbid people to marry and ordered them to abstain from certain foods. So they imposed rules on people. And then in 2 Timothy, another letter that Paul wrote to Timothy later, he says, their teaching will spread. Among them are two guys called Hymenaeus and Philetus, who have wandered away from the truth. They say that the resurrection has already taken place. So it's a real mix of different kinds of teachings. It's hard to tie it down to one single kind of doctrine. But what we do know that Paul says in Timothy is that it wasn't the gospel. We know what it wasn't. He says, these false doctrines don't agree to the sound instruction of our Lord Jesus Christ and to godly teaching. So why were they teaching what they were teaching? The first thing Paul says is that they loved their own reputation. And he comes down pretty harshly on them in this. He says in verse 4 of what we read, anyone who teaches these things is conceited and understands nothing. He has an unhealthy interest in controversies and quarrels, and he causes constant friction between men of corrupt mind who have been robbed of the truth and think that godliness is a means to financial gain. The reason that their message changed all the time was because they were playing to what people wanted to hear. They set themselves up as kind of philosophers or teachers, and they'd go about the town teaching things to different people. And if someone didn't look happy with what they were teaching them, they might change slightly what they were going to say to them. The reason they were doing that was because they loved their own reputation. They wanted to build up their own reputation. They wanted to be popular in Ephesus. And Paul comes down on them really harshly for that. First of all, he says, they're conceited. They understand nothing. And this translation says conceited. Another translation of the Bible says they were puffed up with conceit. Literally, they were fatheads, basically. They loved themselves. They loved getting recognition from other people. They were the kind of people who would love it if this room was covered in mirrors, because they'd be able to see their own face on the floors and in the ceiling and on the walls and on the doors. They cared about what other people thought about them, and they wanted to build a reputation for themselves. This is the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican, where the Pope lives. And it was painted by Michelangelo, famous artist. Apparently when he painted it, he tied a candle to his forehead. The reason that he tied a candle to his forehead was that so whilst he was painting the ceiling, his shadow wouldn't intrude on any of the work that he was doing. So he didn't want any part of himself to intrude onto that painting, because he wanted people to look at that painting and be pointed upwards to Jesus. The false teachers in Ephesus were the kind of people who were the opposite of that. They wouldn't have just wanted their shadow to intrude on it. They would have wanted their face to have covered all of the walls and the ceilings and every part of it, because they wanted people to see them. They weren't interested in pointing people upwards to Jesus. They wanted people to see themselves. So first of all, they're conceited. Second of all, it says they had an unhealthy interest in controversies and quarrels about words. So they cared about the little things. They missed the main thing. And that's challenging for us, I think, as well. Sometimes, and to my shame, I've been in church meetings at the church that I used to be a part of when I was growing up. And they were quite boring sometimes. And we'd be discussing things. And then sometimes this kind of little argument would strike up, and people would be arguing over something that didn't really matter, to be honest. But a really twisted part of me in some ways thought, oh, that's good. Kind of enjoyed that, because it brought some excitement to the meeting. And that's wrong, and I need to repent of that, definitely. But I think we can do that sometimes, can't we? We think this is getting a bit boring, like we're just following Jesus and loving him and trying to spread his word and work together. We seem to do the same things. And then this little controversy comes up about something, not a primary issue, but something. It says about words, maybe it's about a little translation, something that doesn't really matter. And we think, oh, excellent, some kind of drama, like we can get into it, we can have this little argument. I don't know, it might just be me. There might be no one else who struggles with that kind of thing. But it's wrong if you do, because we miss the main thing. So they miss the main thing. They're conceited. And lastly, Paul says they're corrupt, and then they think that godliness is a means to financial gain. So they don't just love their own reputation. They love money as well. And once he said that about the false teachers, Paul then goes on to talk more generally about that and says in verse 10, the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, or all types of evil. Notice he doesn't say money. Money in itself is good. It's helpful. We wouldn't really function as society without money. But he says the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. And I could give probably loads of examples of that. We could talk about the recent scandal at Barclays. We could talk about footballers. There was a guy a few years ago called Yap Stam. Some of you might remember. Played in defence for Man United. Moved to Lazio. The reason he turned down a contract to move to Lazio, turned down all this money at United and signed a contract for £90,000 a week at Lazio, said in the press conference that he just needed to put bread on the table for his family. That is expensive bread. But we could come up with loads of examples, but actually there's more subtle ones maybe as well. The love of money is a root of all types of evil. Someone who commits rape, who's had their addiction to pornography fed by someone who wants to sell magazines or DVDs to make money. Someone who is addicted to drugs or to alcohol, who's had that addiction fed by someone who wants to sell drugs or alcohol to make money. Someone who commits armed robbery or something, who's got their firearm because someone wants to sell it, presumably to make money. There's more subtle ways, and also there's ways that it affects us as well. One of the worst things we could do, I think, is to read this and go, oh yeah, those bankers at Barclays, or oh, those footballers who earn loads of money, and kind of sit up on our high stools and look down condescendingly at people. And yeah, those things are wrong, definitely. But what about examples closer to home? How do we love money more than we love Jesus, essentially? If you got a pay rise, do you think, oh, excellent, more money for me to go out and spend? Or do you think, oh, I've got a bit more money, I can live off what I'm living off, I'll just give that away? If you bet or gamble or play the lottery or anything else, do you do that because you think you just need a bit more money because you can never quite have enough money? I don't know, there's examples that I can think of from my own life, which I might share in a minute. But what I'd like us to do is just think of some examples for a couple of minutes. In a few minutes' time, Kez is going to run around in her new trainers, look out for them, with a roving mic. And I'd like us to just share a few examples, maybe, of how are we tempted maybe to put our own reputation before Jesus? How are we tempted to maybe love money more than Jesus? How do we see that in other people's lives as well? I'd encourage you to be open and honest. Like, let's share some things together. None of us are perfect. None of us have got it sorted. And just think about how those things might play out in our lives. Any examples from the past, or things we're struggling with at the moment, or things we might think would be a problem. So for a couple of minutes, think to yourself and talk to the people around you. Introduce yourself if you don't know them. Just think about how might those things play out in your life. Then we'll share a few examples together in a couple of minutes. Okay, if you want to just draw your conversations to a close, if anyone wants to share anything, which would be brilliant and really helpful for us to just share some of the ways that could affect us, if anyone wants to share anything, could you just stick your hand up and Kez will come towards you with a mic? Cool, well thanks to everyone who shared. Kez's work's done. So yeah, some of those points people shared are really helpful. And just really quickly, some of the risks of those kind of things, of relying on money. First, Paul says disunity. He talks about how in verse 4 he says, you know, the fact these false teachers are teaching out of a love for themselves and a love for money and trying to please others, they've caused massive problems. He says it results in envy, in strife, so in striving to compete with each other, malicious talk, putting each other down, evil suspicions, not trusting each other, and constant friction between people. Isn't that just the complete opposite of the kind of community that we want to be part of? Isn't that the absolute opposite of what we want us as a church to be marked by, of how we'd like us to be described? It leads to disunity. And Paul goes on to say it leads to destruction as well. He says in verse 9, people who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap, into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. Some people, eager for money, have wandered away from the faith and pierce themselves with many griefs. Don't miss the seriousness of that verse. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Some people, because they wanted a bit more, because they wanted to build up their own reputation, have turned their backs on Jesus to try and get a bit more. They've turned their backs on eternal life with him to try and make a bit more in this life. And that was really painful for Paul, I think, to write that, because he might have even known these people. They were from within the church. To have turned their back on it and said, actually, I want a bit more money. Actually, I want a bit more of this. Actually, I want that stuff. Actually, I want to build my reputation. That was really painful and serious for Paul. And there's a lot in the Bible on money, perhaps because God knows how serious it can be, because God knows how destructive loving it can be. It's a guy called John Piper, who's a teacher in America. He says, covetousness, or coveting things, is when you desire something so much that you lose your contentment in God. Money can be a problem because we can covet it, because we can want it. We can desire it so much, or we can desire stuff or to build our reputation so much that we lose our contentment in God. Solomon was one of the richest kings of all time. He had loads of power, he had loads of wealth, he had loads of women, he had loads of pleasure, he had loads of everything. And yet he wrote in Ecclesiastes, whoever loves money never has money enough. Like Chrissy said, we always want a little bit more. If I only had a bit more of it. And he wrote a whole book about how it's like almost chasing after the wind. You can never really catch it. Paul talks about it here. He says you get stuck into this kind of cycle, into a trap, he says. You keep going round and round trying to get a bit more, trying to build it up for yourself. And you're never completely content because you always want a little bit more. But Paul says that actually we can find true contentment. That as people, we can be completely content. He says, these people think godliness is a means to gain. But actually, Paul says, godliness with contentment is gain. Being godly, being like Jesus, telling others about Jesus, isn't about trying to gain something. It is gain in itself. Being godly, following Jesus, and being content in that is great gain. And that's not to say that we don't need the necessities. Paul recognizes that. He says, yeah, we do need food and water and shelter and clothing. But Jesus said, God knows you need those things. God knows that you need these basics. And Paul says, if we've got those things, we'll be content with that. And he makes a really interesting point and a really good reminder that really challenged me. We brought nothing into this world and we can take nothing out of it. There's a story about a vicar who took a funeral service of an old lady who he knew, and a man came up to him at the end and said, oh, how much did she leave behind? And the vicar said, everything, because you can't take anything. We come into the world with absolutely nothing and we go out with absolutely nothing, and yet sometimes we just want to build stuff up, we want to get stuff, we want to collect stuff, we want to make our lives not just comfortable at the basic level but a bit more comfortable and a bit more comfortable. True contentment can only be found in Jesus. If you don't know Jesus, he says he offers life to the full. It's not just some kind of life where you put yourself down and try not to do certain things. He brings life in all its fullness to the full, that's exciting and joyful and fulfilling like nothing else can be. And if you do know Jesus, but you think that isn't your experience, then I'd question maybe how well you know him. Because Jesus says, only I can satisfy. Only I can give you true contentment. And it might sound blasé because some of you might be thinking, yeah, I want to be content, but I'm really suffering with this. I've got a friend who's really ill. I've got a family member who's really struggling, or I'm really struggling with something. How can I be content? And that's really hard. And it's something we're going to be thinking about next Sunday morning that Paul's going to be speaking on. But Jesus knows how you feel. Jesus knows what you need. He knows you better than you know yourself. And he says, don't worry, trust me for the basic things in life. And I've got everything else covered. Be content in me, is what Jesus says. Hebrews 13, 5-6 says, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God said, never will I leave you and never will I forsake you. Jesus was separated from God on the cross so that we never have to be. Never will I leave you and never will I forsake you. We can know true contentment in Jesus. Paul says a couple of other things just quickly. He says, flee these things. He says, run away. If you even catch yourself for a minute loving money, thinking some thoughts, or wanting to build up your own reputation, take those thoughts captive. It's really good to recognize those. It's good some people shared some things. It's helpful for us to recognize those things and then take them captive. Acknowledge them and then flee from them. But we're not just running blindly. We're not just running away from stuff. We're running towards something. We're running towards someone, towards Jesus. God says, pursue godliness, pursue Jesus, chase after these things because they're good. And fight for the gospel, fight the good fight of faith. And it's a good fight because we're guaranteed to win. Because we're fighting not to try and hold our own burdens, but to let someone else carry those burdens for us. We're not fighting to try and build up our own reputation. We're fighting to just be humble. It can be hard sometimes, but God is with us and we do it in God's strength. So pursue godliness, fight for the gospel, and then lastly, embrace your new life. When Paul says take hold of your new life, it's really interesting. The words he used, take hold, are the same words when Jesus grabs Peter to stop him sinking, or when the Roman soldiers grab Simon of Cyrene to get him to carry Jesus' cross, or when Paul's arrested, it says they grabbed or took hold of Paul. It's almost got a kind of violent edge to it. Take hold of the new life in Jesus. Grab it. Embrace it. Enjoy it. Don't just say, oh, I've got new life in Jesus, but I'm not really fulfilled. Don't just know you've got it. Live in it. Participate in it. Spend time worshipping him and loving him and telling him how much he means to you. Love spending time with other Christians in your family, building each other up. And love being on mission together, because it's what we're created to do. Jesus gives us the life that we were created for. And only in that new life can we be content. It's really nice, isn't it, to think of contentment, as opposed to that chasing after the wind, that being stuck in a cycle that Solomon talks about. To say, actually, yeah, I'm content in Jesus. And the false teachers in Ephesus couldn't say that. They weren't content in Jesus. They wanted more. The results were really devastating. But let's make sure the opposite is true for us. Let's make sure that nothing gets in the way, but that Jesus is just center in our lives, that he's central, that we're happy and content in him. And if that's true of all of us, as a church, as people together, if we keep the main thing, then we'll be people who are marked not by envy and strife and malicious talk and everything else, but people who are marked by people who put others first. People who are on a mission together. People who love each other, who are gentle and kind and compassionate, and other people see Jesus in them. And I really hope and pray that's the kind of church that other people see us as. If you're really struck by anything, if you want to pray through anything with anyone, then there'll be the prayer team at the end, or turn to people around you. If you're aware that isn't your experience at the moment, you're not completely content in Jesus, it's okay to recognize that. But don't just go tonight. Talk to God about it. Pray with others about it. Grab someone and speak with them. And make sure that Jesus is at the center of your life, so that you're fulfilled and so he is glorified.